Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way to our conversation, I'll remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Wherever you live, if you want to buy a home in Baltimore and are a first or second time home buyer, there may be a home here for you at 1-800-638-7781. Well, we are about to have a conversation that I've been wanting to have on this show for a long time. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson joins us. His latest book is Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And he is one of our leading astrophysicists. He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He's been hosting Nova Science Now, and is a man that Bill Maher just loves to have on the air. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
He does love you, doesn't he?
I've been on three times within 14 months.
Well, maybe I've just watched it only three times then.
No, but I've been on Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert more than the times I've been on Bill Maher. So the difference is on Bill Maher, he repeats the show every day of the week.
Right.
That it, after that the show is cut. And so I think every subscriber to HBO ends up coming across it at one time of day or another.
Number here, by the way, is 410-319-8888. So we're here to talk about this book and many other things with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
You even have to limit to the book. Just anything in the universe is fine.
Well, that's good, because that leaves us a lot of room, man.
I don't want to constrict you or anything,
really?
But, you know.
I was getting worried for a while, so this is good.
The book is a piece of me, you know, but there's more where that came from.
Well, there's so much here. One of the things, just to introduce our listeners, many of whom know who you are and some may not, that just to go back for a moment, I mean, as a young man, as a kid growing up in New York City, I read this piece about you once, of being a young man in New York, very athletic, really good at athletic prowess, and especially as a young black man in New York City, many people said, you should play basketball. Don't worry about astrophysics.
Yeah, no one had. They weren't thinking in the way I was thinking. I think it was a cultural bias that perhaps they weren't even self-aware of, because they were only recommending professions for me where other people of my skin color had already been seen and established, and that did not include science. It did not, especially didn't include astrophysics. So they see I could, you know, play basketball. Oh, you should, you know, get a basketball scholarship and do basketball. Or I wrestled as well. Yeah, you should get. And no one was thinking. You know, and I stayed after school for the physics club, and they're saying, oh, you should do this. So, you know, nobody was thinking that way. And so I had to, a lot of the initiative was self-driven. It was not, there were no teachers saying, oh, he'll go far, or he'll succeed, or it just never happened.
So now, what was it that brought you that this passion for astronomy, for physics? Where came from?
I think I didn't choose it. I think it chose me. I was 9 years old, the first visit to my local planetarium, which in New York is the Hayden Planetarium.
Which is now your planetarium.
Well, not mine.
Well, you know what I mean. I'm
head of it, but it's not mine. I'm temporary caretaker of the New York treasure.
There you go.
And it would take a few years, a couple of years, you know, a view of the moon through binoculars that a friend of mine shared with me, and confirmation by in a trip to Pennsylvania that the sky that I saw in New York City's Hayden Planetarium was actually real. I was pretty sure that it was a hoax when I first saw it, because I grew up in the Bronx, and I knew how many stars there were in the night sky. There was about a dozen, no more than a dozen.
Right.
So once I confirmed that and got to think about it a little longer, by the age of 11, if you had asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I'd just simply flat out tell you, astrophysicist. And usually the adults would turn around and walk away at that point. There was very, very little rejoinder that they could bring to that. But that I was good to go from then on. And it was so deep within me that I'm pretty sure the universe chose me.
Well, I'm glad they did. And by the way, the lines were open. We'll get to these calls. Jerry and Mary, you are the first to call us up. We have folks who have logged on to Mark Steiner and the Mark Steiner Show page on Facebook and who have written in to steinershow@gmail.com. We'll get to those emails as well for Neil deGrasse Tyson. So we'll get you in just 1 minute to throw a question in and go back and forth with your questions and mine. I love the way you begin the book, because you really talk about the political struggle around NASA and around space travel and around studying the universe. And there's one line here I just love when how the coverage of this Obama speech at the Kennedy Space Center. You said the supportive press had headlines saying Obama sets sights on Mars, and those who don't like him said Obama kills the space program. So,
yeah, thanks for noticing that opening chapter. It's called Space Politics. I just took off the gloves and went bare-fisted on that one. I just had to call it all as I saw it. And my great lament is not that there's politics in the space program. Of course, there's always politics. There's politics everywhere. It's that I began to notice partisan politics. And if you know, there's no hope of any conversion funding if you have partisan bickering over what the mission statement of an agency should be. An agency that historically had not even been bipartisan, it was nonpartisan over its many years. And so it didn't matter to people that Kennedy launched Apollo, but Nixon's signature was on the moon, and Nixon had the first phone call. You know, this is an American mission, not a Republican or Democratic mission. So that first chapter just calls it all out as I saw it, and the partisan press just looked through the lens that they carried with them and give you two completely different views of the same speech.
But now your lens is interesting because you, after this book came out, you testified before Congress. You have your own very serious views about this administration and other people in government having really kind of a lack of vision about what needs to be done. And so you're very clear about this.
Yeah, very clear. And not that there isn't vision. The Obama administration has vision. But the vision is of the kind where he said, well, yeah, I want to go to Mars. He said this in a speech.
Right.
So there are plans to go to Mars. And there are plans to return to the space station. And this time with a government industry partnership. And I don't have a problem with that either. With private industry participating in this adventure. I don't have a problem with that. But when he say we're going to go to Mars, I say, when? Oh, mid-2030s. So wait a minute. That's under the watch of a president to be named later on a budget not yet established. So what does it mean for a president to promise something that they don't have to actually invest in? In the 1960s, when Kennedy gave his famous moon speech, he said we'll go to the moon before the decade is out. Had he served two terms, we basically would have gone to the moon under his watch.
Mm-hmm.
We had a delay with the Apollo 1 fire of almost 2 years of launches. And so had things gone well, we would have. So his political capital and his sort of investment in that mission statement would have been available to carry it through to the end. And it was nonetheless carried through on his legacy. But to promise something that won't happen for another 22 years. You know, I'm not convinced that's a meaningful promise. And by then, you know, Obama's going to be in the beaches of Hawaii by then, as he should be. But
what?
By the way, another cross blame was of course the shuttle ended under Obama, right? And so everyone's
right.
Blaming him for killing the space program. But of course, the calling for the end of the shuttle began under Bush. Bush called for the end of the shuttle. But the Obama haters couldn't look back in 5 years in time to notice this.
Right. It's all Obama's fault.
It was all Obama. Right.
But, you know, I was thinking about that and something else, a little line in the book, almost a throwaway, but it really wasn't. When I was looking at the New York Times photograph of the shuttle being carried on the back of the Boeing 747, I suppose, whatever that was, flying the shuttle to be housed. So people could look at it, and then
it's permanent rest home.
Permanent rest home. You wrote, it was one line in the book. I can't remember where it is. I don't have it online, but it was something about when we went to space between the Russians and the Americans. There were two countries that were in space, and now there's still two countries in space, but we're not one of them.
That's correct. And so in the 1960s, Soviet Union and United States were the two spacefaring nations of the world. Spacefaring defined by the ability to launch humans into orbit and beyond. There's still two spacefaring nations now, but one of them is not America. It's Russia and China. That's right. And so in the book, there are tweets in the book.
Yes,
the
I
book
noticed, is, yes.
It's every thought I've ever had about our past, present, and future in space. And that includes a few dozen tweets that I don't know if how many of your listeners are in the Twitterverse, but it's a way to just put a thought morsel out there, And some people say, oh, I'm in the park now. I'm going to see Harry Potter now. And I don't do that. I don't have time, patience, interest. And if you're interested in my doing that, I'm not interested in you. So I'm an educator. I'm a scientist. And so I put out there perspectives, that morsels of perspectives that I hope offer you different views on operations of culture and its intersection with science. An example. When the last shuttle came in for a landing, people were shed a tear, and there was people saying, "Oh, end of an era," and I said, "No, you're not shedding a tear because it's the last shuttle." Because people are not even in touch with their own emotions, right? I accuse them of not knowing why they're crying, and I'll tell you why. They're crying because there's not another vehicle on an adjacent launch pad ready to continue that adventure. Nobody shed a tear at the end of the Gemini missions because the mighty Saturn V rocket was right next door.
Mm-hmm.
You said, good riddance, we're done with you, you're little, you're small, you can't get us to the moon, goodbye. Bye-bye. We're ready for the next trip here. And so it's that sense of mission statement that I think we're missing, and if it were there, nobody would have shed a tear. They said, "You served us well, shuttle. I salute you. On to the next challenge."
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8880. We just lost one caller. Mary, I want you to call back because you were going to tell Dr. Tyson a story about about how your son has been inspired to go into this world because of him. We want to hear that. Let me read this email, then we're going to go to the phones. Hi, Mark and Dr. deGrasse Tyson. This weekend, I attended the second USA Science and Engineering Festival at the D.C. Convention Center. It was a huge, exciting, well-attended free event with many, many demonstrations and experiments for kids of all ages to participate in. However, considering that it was in D.C., Chocolate City, there was a low African-American attendance, -10%. This was just the kind of event that we could have sparked young black children's interest in science. I know there are so many potential young geniuses, innovators out there. How can we reach them and develop them when they might lack good school programs, adequate lab facilities, and high expectations? Rhonda Robinson.
Yes, that's an important question. I don't have the silver bullet answer to that, but I'm assuming in the numbers that were in that communication, they're saying only about 10% were black, whereas Washington, D.C. is, what's the number, 80%?
Well, it's less now, but it's high, yes.
It's high. It's high. Certainly 50% at least.
Right.
So the numbers weren't matching. I had a similar experience. I was on a panel at Howard with Richard Dawkins, who's a well-known evolutionary biologist, and of late he has these sort of atheistic tracks.
Yes.
And so I was on stage with him, not about any of that, but the title of this conversation was The Poetry of Science. And all we did was talk about the beautiful things in the universe. On the campus of Howard University, on the campus, I would say one out of 20 people in the room was black.
Wow.
Now you know, bringing it to the middle, you can't do more than that, than bring it right into the auditorium in the center of the Howard University's campus. So most of the people came from around the city and around the region, and so your is that an email that you read?
From Rhonda Robinson. Yeah.
The question is an important one. I don't have an easy answer. I don't. I think I'm pretty much as visible as I can be, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm out there. And so my hope is that there's some seeds planted so that there's more of me out there. I don't want to carry this alone. No matter the color of the others, there aren't that many people bringing science to the public. And I'd like to think that perhaps there's a generation lag. You know, if you're the first to go to college, you're not thinking astrophysics. You're not thinking science. You're thinking law, medicine. You're thinking sort of the traditional money-earning fields. It's sort of the luxury of, okay, I don't have to worry about where my next meal is coming from. I'm a kid. I'm not in poverty. And I have the luxury of just looking around. I say, oh, that looks good. Let me poke around at that. And so these professions that are not shown on television dramas are accessible. But they're there, but no one is thinking about them because your first concern is, can you be financially stable? And you don't know how to be financially stable doing these other exotic fields. But you do know that you can be an accountant, a nurse, a doctor, and any of these other traditional fields. So that's my guess, but I don't claim deep insight there. And it's a problem, and it remains a problem.
And Paul writes in on the Mark Steiner Facebook page. He writes in, my son had to recite, Paul Soroka, my son had to write a poem in his high school this past week. He chose Death by Black Hole, written by Neil deGrasse Tyson. So take that, Shakespeare.
Well, excellent, excellent. The title of my book a couple of books ago, Death by Black Hole. In between Death by Black Hole and the space book was the book on Pluto, the Pluto Files, where I chronicle all the hate mail that I got from angry third graders for being an accessory in the demotion of Pluto. But I'm pleased that's getting out there. And, of course, there are YouTube clips of me saying a lot of this. So I don't think I'm inaccessible. I think I'm there. And so now we need parents who will guide their kids. And maybe there's a parent education plan that needs to be put into place for this.
I want to open the phones here. Like Jerry, Clarence, Lucas, the next three callers up, the others coming in, we're going to get to all your calls, I promise that. But let me just launch it this way, because I want to get to the kind of heart of this latest work that you've written, just to, so we can get it out there. Because you write that space exploration is a necessity. And you look at how, when I was a kid in the 60s, science and being a scientist and thinking about going into science and whether it was astronomy or physics or whatever was something you want to do. It was people were held up in the limelight. Now it's just the opposite.
It is true that there's more access to science today than ever before. In other words, if you decide to channel surf on any given evening, you don't have to go that far or that long before you'll hit a network given unto science programming. In the old days, the most you could get was maybe Jacques Cousteau or the animal guy, Marlo Perkins. And that wasn't really science. That was more sort of descriptive animal studies, you know.
Yeah.
Here are the mating habits of the stingray or whatever. So there's more access to science. The difference is, I think, that in the 60s, the moon was the greatest expression of the application of what it is to be scientifically literate. And, of course, it took more than science. It took engineers. It took technologists. It took mathematicians. And everybody knew that. So you couldn't stand up in the 60s and badmouth science because you had no place to stand in order to even express yourself that way, because everyone would just laugh you down, because it was manifest in the weekly headlines what the power of science literacy was doing for our dreams and our ambitions. And the World's Fair here in New York City was all about tomorrow. And who was bringing you that tomorrow? The technologists, the engineers. So that was a very dreamy period, and layered on top of the bloodiest decades since the Civil War in American history, with the Civil Rights Movement unfolding weekly on the headlines, and Vietnam, a Cold War, a hot war, leaders assassinated, the Tet Offensive in 1968. And yet, nonetheless, people were dreaming. And I don't see that today.
But it also has to do with something that happened, as you write eloquently about, which is that we were on a war footing to build a space program, and that's gone, and we've decided that's not what we need to invest in our future. But you insist that we won't have a real future if we don't invest in the space program.
Yeah, so that there are three mixed pieces there, so let me unpack it.
Yeah.
In the 60s, we went to the moon. We tell ourselves, erroneously tell ourselves, that we did it because we're explorers or we're discoverers, or it's in our DNA, or that's what great countries do. But the fact is, we were at war. NASA was founded in a war climate. Russia had put up Sputnik, which was a hollowed-out intercontinental ballistic missile, not widely mentioned at the time, but the military folks knew what that meant. It meant the Soviet Union had the new high ground, and this was our sworn enemy, so we had to do something about it. We launch, pun intended, we launch a new space agency, NASA. It's designated as a civilian space agency. Okay. And by the way, in the book, in the appendix, I have the original documents that created the agency. You get to see the language that's used. Meanwhile, every astronaut all but two of the astronauts we put up are drawn from the military pilots, from the Air Force, from the Navy, and from the Marines. And so you say, well, what's going on here? And then we get to the moon. The space enthusiasts are saying, oh, this is our adventure, and we're on the moon by 1969, we'll be in Mars by 1985. And when it was clear that Soviet Union was not going to Mars, going to the moon, there was no reason for us to continue. So retrospectively, it's obvious why we stopped. once you put the right causes and effects on the system. Today, if China said they want to put military bases on the on Mars, we're on Mars in 10 months. 1 month to fund, design, build, and manufacture the spacecraft, and 9 months journey to get there. So, of course, we would respond, probably in like ways as we did in the 60s. But I don't want war to be the reason why we do this. Economics is no less a powerful or potent a driver than war. And the promise of economic return when this great adventure stimulates an innovation culture, an innovation nation, then that those are the seeds of tomorrow's economies. And that will drag us out of these doldrums we've been in for the past decades.
Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is with us. Let's go to the phones, as I promised, and I will interject my questions as we go. 410-319-8888 is the number here. His latest book is Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And Jerry, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Very well, welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
Mm-hmm. I think that it's very important to talk about science, but I think we have to talk about what fuels science, what takes it to that higher level where the universe wants us to be. And I think mathematics as, at its most highest level is going to be literally, should be literally that fuel to take us there. And as we talk about mathematics and as far as we can go with mathematics, that's not in the mainstream science world. That's not being done in your federal science world either. So I'm saying, that, I mean, Dr. Tyson, you know, people like him, they ought to be talking about topics like this, topics that are not being talked about. So I'm saying if you want to use science as far as you can go, you have to use that tool. And mathematics is that tool. And I don't see that being done.
That's a really important point, Jerry. Then you do talk about numbers and mathematics a great deal in this book.
Yeah, yes, I do. So just to the caller's point, the caller is 100% correct. Right, math is fundamental to all of this, and in fact, the new acronym of the decade, STEM, the STEM field, science, technology, engineering. That M at the end of STEM stands for mathematics.
Right.
So it is there when we describe STEM fields, and it is. Anytime someone puts funding for science, the math is implicit in what gets funded. So it is there. The difference, and by the way, mathematics is, as far as we can tell, the language of the universe. You know, you want to go to China and speak to the natives, you learn Chinese. You want to go to the universe and have and converse with the universe, you learn mathematics. And so no doubt about that.
We have to take a really brief break and come right back. And we will. And with Dr.
Okay.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, the book is Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Don't go away. We're going to come back and get to our callers. Clarence and Lucas calling in and other people on Facebook have written in. We'll get to as many as we can. So join us here. Don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about his latest work, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, and many of the things facing us in the universe. So we'd like to see faces in the universe. I promise to go right to the phones, and I will. Let's who's next up is Clarence. You're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Steiner. Good evening, Mr. Steiner and Doctor.
How are you?
I didn't want it. I was. This is maybe taking a conversation away from where it was, but if you subscribe in the theory of alchemy, cosmic alchemy, and you're looking at a star that collapses on itself and creates the gravity creates a black hole, and it's sucking in matter all around it, has anybody ever got a theory on where this matter? You cannot destroy energy. You can't create it, and you can't destroy it. Has anybody got a theory? Because I've been looking for it on the internet, a theory as to where this matter and energy is reemerging, and I haven't been able to find anybody that's looking in or hypothesizing on that particular part of it. And would you think that if it is reemerging as some kind of dark matter, that maybe that's why the universe seems to be expanding and the furthest reaches are moving further away from us? I didn't want to ask that question because,
no.
But you know. Thank you.
Well, sure. So,
I'm glad you asked a question. It goes right to the heart of a lot of what Dr. Tyson thinks about. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you've got a good nose for real problems in the universe. So, first of all, you use the phrase cosmic alchemy, and that's a kind of a fun phrase that has been invoked for what goes on in a galaxy where stars manufacture heavy elements, right up the periodic table of elements from the lightest to the heaviest. Then they explode, scatter them into the rest of the galaxy, enabling subsequent generations of stars to form with planets that are made of these extra ingredients. And so it's the alchemist's dream, right? Because the alchemist wanted to turn one element into another element. They didn't know you couldn't do that on a tabletop, but it happens routinely in the centers of stars. So the word alchemy is a fun, a very applicable term to what's going on there. That's different from what goes on in a black hole. A black hole, just, you know, you get too close, you get sucked in. There you have it. All understanding of what goes on in a black hole tells us that the matter, it gets sucked down to an infinitesimal point in its center. We call it the singularity. And so you say, how could all this matter take up no volume in the middle? Well, probably can't. We just don't have a theory to understand the singularity. So until we have a theory to understand the singularity, we just say it goes to a singularity. The string theorists think they have an out there. And so we have top people working on merging the physics of a black hole with the physics of a singularity. And that's a frontier subject going on right now. And the solution to that would help us understand what was going on at the moment of the Big Bang as well, when the entire universe was very small. So when you have a lot of mass occupying small volume, this is the job of string theorists. And they're still at it. They're still scratching their heads. And maybe they're barking up the wrong tree. We don't know, but they're currently the only game in town. And so, and plus they're not that expensive to support. A computer, a pad, and paper. You know, I'll carry a string theorist. The deep thinkers. And you always need a deep thinker in arm's reach.
So, but you would like to see us do more thinking and acting to get into deep space.
Yeah, oh, by the way, oh, one other point, I'm sorry, I should have included.
Sure,
there was an idea, by the way, the mathematical opposite of a black hole is a white hole. And it was suggested that, and it shows up in the equation, and it was suggested that maybe black holes connect to white holes via a wormhole. And so that everything goes into a black hole and comes out the other side.
Hmm.
So you can predict what a white hole should look like in the universe, and we don't see them. And so that was a brief, fun moment in the late or mid-1970s where that was a suggested idea. So as far as we know, you fall in the black hole, that's where you are. That's you. That's where you stay.
Let's go back to the phones, I promise, to get a couple more calls in here. 410-319-8888. Lucas, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark, and hi, Dr. Tyson. My name is Ray Lucas, and I'm glad you brought up the historic moment of Sputnik, because I was a part of somebody that got swept up in that sent me in a STEM direction, that ultimately put me in an IT career.
Oh, okay, so you felt the force. You felt this force directing you to study just those careers that would contribute to that whole adventure.
Absolutely. And my frustration, though, is I'm watching all of these Sputnik moments get wasted. For example, when 9/11 hit, you know, because you talk about Sputnik being kind of in the shadow of us battling with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And 9/11 hits, and our leadership tells us to go shopping rather than tell our kids to study harder, you know. and you know, I remember when my daughter was in elementary school in the 80s, and she's the one that came home as the recycle police that got us to recycle. I mean, mm-hmm. Those transforming moments that really transform society. And I think we're missing a lot of those, and we got to figure out how to capitalize.
Mm-hmm. So
go ahead,
here's
Neil.
The thing. The Sputnik moment, sorry about that ringing in the background. It's another phone. But I'm good with you.
That's okay, man. It's fine.
In Obama's State of the Union speech, he commented that the we have a new Sputnik moment. He was commenting on the that our economy is in a bad shape and China is eating our lunch. And so he then said, this Sputnik moment, and commented on how we responded in the 1960s to that Sputnik moment. He says, for this Sputnik moment, I propose the following. And then he gave the list, and it was like, no, that's not a Sputnik response. He said, we should have high-speed rail by 2025 and high-speed internet by 2030 and energy independence by 20. And I'm thinking, we should have that anyway. Talk about wasted Sputnik moments. Don't pretend like you. This is what you need to give me that. I'm sorry.
So
it should be, here's a Sputnik moment. We're going to Saturn. Okay, that's now you're talking.
So talk about in leading off from that, what you said to what your testimony was to the U.S. Congress, and because I understand from what I've read, it was kind of no holds barred. You said what you thought needed to be done to make this work.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. So the book, Space Chronicles, the opening chapter is called Space Politics, and that chapter was excerpted and became the cover article for Foreign Affairs magazine. Now, that's not my journal. I mean, I'm a scientist, and I publish elsewhere, but policy people read that journal all around the world, and apparently a copy of that lands in the lap of every member of Congress as soon as it comes out, and I think it's a two-month issue date. So it came out right when the book came out, and within 2 days of that, I get an invitation to testify in front of the Senate about our future in space. And so I said, okay, I'll do that. And so I go, and there's three senators out of, I think, a dozen committee members. This is the Committee on Commerce, Transportation, and Science. So I was disappointed with how many committee members showed up, but then I realized, this message is not for Congress. This message is for the electorate,
mm-hmm.
because it's the Congress works for us, right?
Right.
So if my efforts here do anything, they should compel the electorate to compel their elected leaders. So turns out there was a C-SPAN wasn't there, but there was a camera that recorded it, and it's now posted on YouTube. And it has very warm responses from people. And within a few days, it had several hundred thousand views. So I was very heartened by the response. And I just said we forgot how to dream. The 1960s, we dreamed, and it was about tomorrow and what role technology would play. A lot of what we've discussed in this phone call. And that the... you have to view space not as a handout each year, but as a fundamental investment in the future of our nation. And that's the summary of my 5 minutes of commentary. But that's what it was, and people resonated deeply with it.
I mean, what do you think our future will be in this country without a serious space program? I mean,
that's exactly the right question, because so often we say, what will happen if we do it? The better question is, what happens if we don't?
Right.
And in economics, they call it the opportunity cost. The cost of not doing something is huge. Unless you can figure out some other way to stoke the economy. So here's what they do. They say, the jobs are going overseas. I have a solution. Let's put tariffs on that, on what they're making, and let's give tax incentives. And that's a Band-Aid. Kids aren't going into science. Oh, let's train science teachers, make better. That's another Band-Aid. So here's what happens. If you go into space in a big way and you have huge discoveries writ large across the headlines, people will see the value of science and engineering and technology and math. Kids will want to enter those fields because it's exciting and it's fun and the media is talking about it. And TV shows will reference it. Then you stimulate an innovation culture. And what happens? Those people... they innovate as they get older. Whether or not they're involved in the space field, we have an innovation nation. And innovation are the engines of tomorrow's economies. So if you innovate, now you have a factory that's building something that you just innovated. Your jobs can't go overseas because they haven't figured out how to do it yet. and you don't need programs to convince kids that science is interesting, because the interesting science discoveries are writ large in the daily newspapers. In fact, you might even have to beat them back. Not only that, even if you're not in the STEM fields themselves, let's say you're a producer, then you might produce a TV show that's related to the science of the cosmos. If you're an artist, you might be inspired by cosmic themes. If you're a journalist, you might write more articles on what those stories are doing. Everybody becomes a participant when you're an innovation nation. And I know of no force as potent as that of space exploration. When you're advancing a frontier, you got to invent and innovate every day you're out there.
Let me return to the phones. I have a few more questions. I really want to get to this new Cosmos coming up and talk about intelligent design and the things that you've written about in this book. 410-319-8888. But let's go to the phones first. And on longest, Chris in Woodlawn, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good evening, gentlemen. My statement is I applaud your work. And as a Fordham prep kid from Southern Boulevard myself, who spent a lot of time in the planetary.
Oh, excellent.
In the Museum of Natural History, where I took classes on Saturday morning dissecting sharks.
Now, what you're not telling me is whether you had your first kiss in the back row of the planetary.
Actually, it was right there by the bathroom before you go into the... but anyway, what you were saying about that, well, my question, and I just want to go back real quick. My question to you is, I have a six-year-old daughter, and I live here in Baltimore now, and I've made it my business to take her back to the Bronx Zoo, where I took classes there also. I was always into biology. How do I turn it from interest into action? Because you can interest the kid, and that's what I'm trying to do, but I want to make sure I get her interested enough to want to follow up on it on her own to continue
That's an excellent and important point, because I think what you don't want to do is force them into anything, because then the consequence of that can be just total rejection of any of your advice at all. And I can tell you what my parents did, which is similar to what you're doing, but there's a little extra twist. I'm three siblings, and so my parents, every weekend, I grew up in New York City, essentially every weekend, we went on some trip to one cultural institution or another. It was the zoo. It was the art museum. It was the Museum of Natural History. It was the planetarium. And then we did other things. We went to ball games, a baseball game, a hockey game, a football game, the opera, Broadway plays, Broadway musicals. And we just continued this. And what this amounted to was a persistent exposure to all the things adults do that earn income, things, professions. It wasn't just the policeman, fireman, Indian chief. It was all the rest of what goes on out here. And it was simply exposure. It wasn't here, you need to be interested in this. It's just check out what they do. And what happened over the years is this exposure distilled into things that I took interest in, things that my brother took interest in, things that my sister took interest in, that was self-driven at that point. And the seeds were planted, and we then pursued those interests. And my brother was especially interested in the art museums. He's now an artist. And my sister now is a corporate executive, but she saw all of how this functioned and how it operated and how it and took it all in, the total package of what the free market economy is all about. And so, and for me, it was my first visit to the Hayden Planetarium. And we all remember our first visit to a planetarium, no matter the city. But for me, it struck, I was starstruck, so that it became my career. And so I think you can't force it. Just keep the exposure coming. And at some point, something will click. And then you nurture that. And that's what I recommend.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. And I one thing I remember you said also, in this book, something else I saw that you wrote, where you said one of the things you have to do with your children is just get out of the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, parents say, what do I do to help my kids get interested in science? Well, they're already curious about the natural world, and you're probably in their way, so just get out of their way, all right? And in fact, a more severe exchange I would have is, not only are you in the way, you're probably the problem. Adults run the world, and, you know, and how many adults have come to me to say they want their kids to be science literate when it's the science illiterate adults that are making decisions about the future of science in this country? So I basically focus on adults.
You know,
they outnumber kids, they wield resources, they're the ones who made all the problems.
Speaking of that, later in the book, in your chapter called America and the Emergent Space Powers, you have this wonderful little riff about your jury duty, which I just loved.
Yeah, you know, I try to be a good citizen, and I get called for jury duty. In fact, right now I have a letter that's probably that I haven't opened for a couple of weeks because I'm behind on my snail mail. But, yeah, you know, every 3 years you get asked. And so, and I dutifully, I get dressed up and put on my tie, and I show up at the courtroom, and they say, well, what's your profession? I say, I'm an astrophysicist. And then 5 minutes later, I'm back on the street, you know. They don't want people who know how to analyze data, all right? Apparently that's not what the legal system is about.
No, we don't want to do that. We don't make a mistake. We don't want to make a mistake. But you...
We want to make sure that the lawyer can influence you emotionally, because the truth doesn't matter as much as their capacity to make an argument. And so that's upsetting right there, you know. So...
But you go on in that chapter to talk about another area of fuzzy thinking you write out there at this moment.
It's a whole fuzzy thinking riff.
Right, is this intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you go into that. So and that is part of the kind of anti-science and anti-intellectualism that's kind of taking hold.
Well, so the thing is, so it's not fuzzy thinking to think that there is intelligent design.
Right.
Okay? Many religious people feel this way.
Right.
That itself is not fuzzy thinking. What's fuzzy thinking is if you think that's science. Okay.
Right.
It is not science. Okay. So it is the public's understanding of what science is and how it works. When that gets compromised or corrupted, then there is no hope for tomorrow's economy, because the engines of tomorrow's economy will come from innovations in science and technology. And if you want to put something that is not science in the science classroom, which is a science classroom is a place where you learn about what scientists do. And if you're going to undermine that, and by the way, school curricula are determined locally, not federally.
Right.
So you could create a school board and vote this stuff in if that's what you chose. Okay? And in a free country, I suppose you have the right to do that. All I'm trying to do is alert you of the consequences of that. And no one wants to die, and especially in this country, no one wants to die poor. And if you don't recognize the significance of and the role of science and engineering in the economic health of the nation, then you are doomed to regress back into the cave, because that's where we're going to wind up as the rest of the world passes us by.
Let me go back to the phones before I come back to my own questions. We have 8 minutes left in the hour with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, the book Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Tyson. As far as your last comment goes about fuzzy thinking and intelligent design, and as much as people might think that's the way to scientifically understand the world better, my question is this. Was the likes of Isaac Newton fuzzy thinking? How about Francis Bacon? The fact is that if you look at the history of science, most of the scientists as science began after the Middle Ages were people who thoroughly and devoutly believed in the creator behind all of this. My question to call in was about the likes of Carl Sagan, how you could explain a person like him who could be so bright, so much of a genius as far as astrophysics are concerned, and yet not notice that God created the universe. Wouldn't you agree, Dr. Tyson, that children, if they're going to be interested in science, before they do so, should have a thorough background in the religious thinking, so that they know that when they see the absolute harmony and the orchestration of the universe, they ask the question, who created these? Otherwise, they wouldn't even notice, because they'd be so jaded, they think that it all happened by chance.
All right. Mike, thanks for your call.
Okay, so first of all, before, I would say, the mid-1700s, essentially every person in society and culture had some religious affiliation. The concept of atheism wasn't really there. The modern atheist efforts started like in the mid-1700s and went on from there. And then when Darwin recognized the evolution, more sort of joined that bandwagon. So Isaac Newton predates the mid-1700s, and so he was a deeply religious man. And in fact, he wrote more about religion than he did about physics.
Right.
So in terms of his total output, in his writings, however, they're not mixed. He knew what was science and what was religion. That's my only point that I was making earlier. And so you have to know what one is and what one isn't, because they are not the same as each other. And so the issue is not who's religious and who isn't. It's what is science and what is not science. That's all I'm referencing here. And so if you want to teach someone religion, there's plenty of occasions to do that, and that's what Sunday school is for, or another faith, you know, synagogue or you know, temple, whatever it is people do, they do it. And the state will not stop you, because we live in a country, we have freedom to express your religion. That does not mean that your religion belongs in the science classroom. So that's first. Second, people already take kids to church. So why that conversation doesn't have to be had with me. That already happens. So I don't know what the concern is there. There being order in the universe and the majesty of the universe, that is, nothing could be farther from the truth. The universe is a dangerous, violent, deadly place. And Earth is dangerous, violent, and deadly. 98% of all species of life there ever were on Earth are now extinct. And so the violence that Earth wreaks upon nature is extraordinary and very high energy. And just look at, for example, we lost 500,000 people in the last 7 years to earthquakes in Haiti and in and the Indonesian tsunami.
Right.
And so look at all the ways Earth is trying to kill us. And to say, well, there's a harmony and a beauty, show children the handiwork of God, if you're honest about that and you want to ascribe nature to God, then you need to show all the ways Earth is killing us. Earth and other sort of biological hazards. And that is the total picture of what's out there, and that is what is revealed when you actually study it. So, but like I said, we live in a free country, and we're religiously pluralistic, we're politically pluralistic, or at least we tell ourselves that. And so no one will stop you from educating your children in this, raising your children as religious kids. I mean, that's fine. But the science classroom, if you believe that you get science from your religion, you will undermine the capacity of your children to ever participate on the research frontier of science, because the two do not mix. And they have actually never mixed successfully. People have attempted that. It's not through any shortage of efforts to try. Isaac Newton tried, and he realized clearly that they did not mix, and so he kept them separate. His religious writings are fundamentally different in tone and in nature and in style and in structure than his physics writings.
Great answer to that question. Thank you. We'll try to get another caller here if we can, but I have a quick question, then we only have like 3 or 4 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
But you're taking over where Carl Sagan left off with Cosmos, but you're putting it on Fox, which I find interesting, as the station is kind of the biggest climate change denier in the media, and Cosmos is going to be, your Cosmos is going to be on Fox.
Well, so first of all, isn't that a good reason then to be on
Fox? Might be, yeah.
So zap, there you go. Next question, okay. Secondly, most people who pass severe judgment on Fox are generally referencing Fox News.
Right.
Not Fox Sports. We all watch Fox Sports. And Fox Dramas, which include sort of House and...
That's true.
And
that's right.
24 for a long time, and Fringe, and Fox is the number one show on television, and in American Idol. Fox is also 20th Century Fox that brought Avatar to the screen, and Fox Light Pictures that brought Slumdog Millionaire. So Fox is a multivariate enterprise, and Fox also has the sort of the liberal acerbic commentary from The Simpsons and Family Guy. Fox has more American demographic streets passing through it than any other network that I know. I mean, so I think of no better venue to put Cosmos as we redo it than on Fox.
That, for want of a better term, amen.
amen. I think amen translates to so be it.
So be it, right?
Amen. And we can do it. Amen.
Amen.
And then after it's on, we say hallelujah.
That's it, right. Hallelujah, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson on Fox. So Cosmos relives. So
it's probably spring 2014 is what the timetable has for it now.
Well, we look forward to it. I look forward to it.
Yeah, thank you for that.
And I really appreciate you taking the hour with us here, Neil. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. Neil deGrasse Tyson's new book, Space Chronicles, and we'll be hopefully have to talk to you again.
Okay, excellent. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye.
Folks, thanks for tuning in and writing in. Hope we couldn't get to all the callers. Apologize, got to as many as we could. And appreciate you all writing and listening to this very important hour we just had with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. The book, again, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. Our assistant producer is Cassandra Monsanto, from the same place as Dr. Tyson is from. Our interns are Alexis Smith, Alex Pearson, and Tiffany Means. We're engineered by Regis Tucker. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and link to our guests' work, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. Marsha Reeves Jew's coming up after me here on WEAA, and for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.